The following podcast contains discussion of a sexual nature, so if you think that might offend you, please turn off now and join us again next week. Thanks. Treating disabled people as asexual is exasperating and offensive, says Penny Pepper, who's on the line now. Hello, Penny.
Hello.
And this was an article you wrote in The Guardian off the back of the film, which we made a lot of hay with a few weeks ago on the podcast, Me Before You.
Yes. So,
but we won't dwell on that too much because we want to get into the meat of this. This is about asexuality, sexuality, all that kind of thing. If you don't like conversation of a slightly more adult persuasion, you might want to turn off now. This is Inside Out, incidentally, and with me is Kathleen Hawkins.
Hello.
Tell us about this asexual. Disabled people are characterised as asexual. What does that mean for you?
Well, that basically, for as long as I can remember, disabled people have been portrayed as asexual because they're always secondary characters. They're always the best friend. All the way back, you could say, to works like what Katie did, where she falls off a swing, damages her back, and then is described as terms like unmarriageable. So we've got a long history of being seen as asexual, from women being seen sort of infantilized and men being kind of emasculated.
Art reflects life, right? And in your article, you talk about, and this sounds fascinating and horrific all at the same time, Penny, you talk about having been in a medical institution, as you describe it, when you were a child, where the staff bullied you and the other disabled kids there and said that you needed to toughen up and that you'd never have sex. Can you tell us a bit about that?
I think it's quite a common experience for disabled people who went to any kind of special school.
So that's what you were talking about, medical, you mean a special school?
Well, it was a special school in a medical institution, in my case, because I was in hospital a lot as a kid, where we were in for like 2 years or 3 years. So it was more like a boarding school than a hospital. It was just we had rehab as well. And the whole mood towards us from a certain age was to realise it was sometimes used as a stick to beat us. You know, you're too fat, no one's going to like you. You're too weak, no one's going to like you. So it was used as a stick to push you into your rehab and your exercise routine. But even from the staff, the everyday staff, the sort of care assistant type nurses, it would be, you know, why are you doing that? Why are you wearing makeup? Why are you... Yeah, why are you... I don't think this is that uncommon. Other creatives and disabled academics have done work around this, but you know, I'm in my 50s and I hope it's got better.
But that must have had an incredibly long lasting impact on you.
Of course. I mean, I just think that in my generation, when I was young, when I was a kid, disability was still very much in the shadow. I grew up very confused. I did have real challenges because of this, because it's constant. It's a drip push on, you know, impressionistic youngsters.
Mm.
The other side of this, of course, is that reality, which is that you know you go through puberty, you're adolescent, and you have new feelings and fascinations, and you think, well, this doesn't make sense. I'm being told to brace myself against the rejection of the world, and yet reality isn't always presenting that to me.
And so how did you kind of feel about your sexuality as a teenager, having been through that, and how did you kind of reclaim that for yourself?
I think the biggest period of rediscovery was through close friendships with older girls, which I touched upon in the Guardian piece. So it was those knowing a bit more, having broken through some of this, having thought, hang on, some of us have found relationships.
And these were the girls at your special school who you said had copies of Cosmo they were reading.
Yes. I feel I was lucky. I had great friends who were slightly older, one or two in particular. you know, they were naughty, I can tell you. I've got a poem about one called Linda in my one-woman show, and she was about 17 when I was 14, and she brought me into the real world of endless possibility, partly by showing me Cosmopolitan and revealing the shocking truth, as that's how I remember it, about oral sex. Can I say that on out?
I'm really not sure.
We'll put it in until we're told to take it out by somebody
else. All right, okay.
Listeners may have heard a beep at that point.
No. All right, okay. So I shouldn't mention masturbation. Well, that have to
go
be beeped?
For it.
Tell us more, Penny.
Well, again, I just think that if you're left to your own devices a little, and in these kind of institutions like places, when you're disabled, and this would apply for disabled boys actually, that how do you, you just have to work something out for yourself if you can't reach yourself, or if you have different sensations on your body due to your impairment or operations. And we navigated all this. And my best friend Linda developed a technique. Mm-hmm. And I can go into more detail. Maybe I shouldn't.
Well, let's see how it goes.
All right, then.
Linda's technique.
You want me to carry on?
Yeah.
I think so. Go on, Penny.
Well, this is also in my book. It's based on, there's a fictional version of this in my book, Desires Reborn, which is the e-book. Out now. It describes the technique of how two young girls realise there's other ways to reach your genitals. With in the case of the story, it's very long cotton buds. Yes.
Where are we getting very long cotton buds from?
Ah, well, they because I was in a hospital environment, hospital school. Even at my boarding school, actually, which is separate, they would have had things like that you could catch because they were used for throat swabs.
Yeah, using the environment. I like it.
I wonder, did they know? Did they have an inkling that they were actually assisting you? They did?
Eventually.
And what happened?
It all became a bit of a kind of open secret, and they were much more embarrassed than we were.
And what? So did they allow these items to be taken away after that point?
Well, no, we would just sneak them. There's loads of ways to do that. We're talking about 75 here, Damon. I told you how old I am. So it was a different environment. But then girls would develop other techniques and other realise there were other possibilities and other
and
things.
Share as well. Just that real sharing community.
Yeah, that kind of slightly giggly but excited sharing, which is great because you kind of know you're being naughty in some way, but you don't have a complete sort of language set. I don't think I realised initially that this was what you term masturbation.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't necessarily in my vocabulary, and if it was, it was something boys did.
So what about partners and sex, Penny? When did this all start for you? Because I know it did.
I had my first little innocent kiss with my childhood sweetheart when I was about 10. When you don't really connect that to sex, I don't think. But you kind of know you're together. Fast forward to when I'm about 19, we had punk.
Oh, nice.
And I will be a punk. I will always describe myself as an ageing punk. It will never leave me. And it exploded into my life.
Did that help then? Did punk help?
Yes, it was this explosion of amazement in my life. And
with punk as well, it's not even just the music, is it? It's that community. You're fitting in straight away. And if you were told at such an early age you won't fit in, you aren't normal, then punk gives you that environment straight away.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, for that happened when I was still at home with my mum. I saw it on the telly. I saw the famous Sex Pistols incident with Bill Grundy. There's a lot of swearing and naughtiness went on. And pretty much the next day, I shaved my eyebrows off and drew on punk ones.
So punk directly led to you having sex for the first time?
I would say, yes, it did.
And can you tell us a bit about that?
What, the sex or how that happened?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a bit embarrassed asking you about this. But, yeah, tell us a little bit about that incident and how it was and what you were expecting. And was it a worry? And did you feel that you might be rejected? And all of that kind of thing that we've been talking about.
Well, I did touch on this in the Guardian article, that one of the weird things is that I'd never been on a date, because this is in a time before social care. By the time I was 14, I was a wheelchair user, like pretty much full time. You just didn't really go anywhere unless you had some sort of volunteer driver that appeared through some long, laborious process with your social worker. There's no access to transport, no access to most of the environment. There certainly wasn't reliable, accessible toilets.
So you're talking about the kind of places that you would go on dates to were made inaccessible.
But also, I had no one to assist me to get there. This was way before. I didn't want my mum. In fact, my family life was quite fraught. There's no way my mum was going to take me to somewhere that she couldn't drive. I mean, it's just a crazy way of living, looking back. So what happened after punk was I got very, very serious about my writing. So I'd written for quite a few fanzines. I'd started writing songs. One of the people who wrote back was called Freddie, and he really liked my work. He liked my demo tapes that I'd just done in my bedroom with a little cheap cassette, all this. And things moved on from there, shall we say, because with a lot of effort and a lot of saving up of my invalidity benefit, I was able to meet him a few times at my friend's house.
So is it a bit trite to say that he first met your mind before he sort of met your body?
No, it isn't in a way. But he knew what I looked like, and I was very punky and slim.
So was your first partner, your first sexual partner, was he disabled or not disabled?
No, not disabled.
And how did that feel for you at the time? Did you feel you'd sort of conquered
something?
No, I was
in love with him. I was in love with him. And he'd made the first moves on me, much to my shock, because I kind of did fancy him, but I was just in this neutral in my mind that again, I should never expect anything. And I suppose what was... this is what's quite funny, and I do have to say it's in my memoir, First in the World Somewhere.
Good plug.
Where it was a lovely shock, where I met him and he was my manager and he was going to help me make a single and all this. And then he just kissed me, a proper snog. And I was like, oh, like this. This is nice. What's going to happen now? And I would say within about 3 months, I decided, yep, I did want to have sex with him. And he certainly wanted to have sex with me. But the background to this, and I'm sure a lot of young disabled people do this even now, and it might even be easier, was we were trying to buy or borrow every kind of book that dared to mention disability and sex, because we didn't know how we were going to do it. Mm. We'd been told we couldn't and that our bodies wouldn't let us do it. So we had things like The Joy of Sex. I don't know if anyone remembers that. They should. It was this famous book.
Yeah.
And it had this horrible beardy man in it. And it's like, it mentioned sex and the handicapped in about one paragraph. And it was like, not sure about that. You know, it didn't have that sense of authenticity.
So you found a way. You found a way of doing it.
Yeah, I can tell you more if you want. But it was really by experimenting. And I would always say this to younger disabled people. You have to be with someone you really trust. So I was in love. I wanted to do this. I was turned on by Freddie. And in terms of what my body could and couldn't do, I don't mind saying I've got arthritis, so my body doesn't move easily. It moved a bit more then, but we found a way, and we found a way slowly, and over the years I learnt more. But also that great thing, I know it's become a bit of a cliche, but and you might have to bleep this, but sex isn't entirely about copulation or penetration. It really isn't. And I learnt that more then, that took me kind of on that journey of exploring sex as a broad palette of sexual expression.
And how did you learn to communicate so well? I feel like that's quite a difficult thing for young people to do in general when they are getting to know their bodies. Was that just a natural thing for you because you felt comfortable with that partner?
I think with him, definitely. But I don't want to make it sound like it was ever easy, because it wasn't. Mm. Oh, I hope younger disabled people have an easier time now. I don't know. I don't feel very, very, very optimistic for them. Mm. Because I think what's happened now, of course, is it's come in this full circle and everyone's obsessed with the perfect body, which is an exterior form of conditioning, and even down to things like undateables, which I don't like, by the way.
That's the Channel 4 reality show where we see disabled people going on dates,
I don't like it. I don't like the premise of it. And if it had been all people, everybody, who's found it difficult to date, come on, Channel 4, expand it, you know, because then it wouldn't seem so in isolation that the only people in the world who need help with dates are disabled people. That's nonsense. Anyway, I do feel for younger disabled people.
Are there resources around? You were saying you just didn't have any literature, and of course the internet didn't exist back then, on ideas on how you could have a sexual relationship with somebody. Is there something around now that you would point?
I think there's a lot of academic stuff. And there's things like, which I contributed to, there's the Tom Shakespeare, Kath Gillespie-Sells book, The Sexual Politics of Disability Sexuality. It's called Untold Desires, that's its subtitle.
And I guess people blogging as well, that must be a huge thing for young people.
I think there's more that can be resourced through the internet. I'm not entirely comfortable with it, but there's definitely a slightly unpalatable strand of disability porn.
Yeah.
Which may lead to the, you know, the general questionability of porn anyway.
Because I was thinking that when I read your article about disabled people being asexualized, it's either kind of asexuality or it's fetishism.
Yeah, I mean, there's the whole devotee thing,
which
mainly focuses around people who are amputees. But
so that's where non-disabled people fancy and want to have sex with disabled people, usually, as you say, with physical bits wrong with them.
Yeah. But very particularly as an obsession. So they're not really interested in you as a whole person. They're interested in your impairment or your scars or your, you know, whatever it is that supposedly turns them on. I've engaged with some of these people in the past to try and unravel it a bit. I sometimes think they don't even know, and they have all these kind of strange theories about, you know,
where it's come from.
Yeah, where it's come from and why it's okay. And I'm not, you know, they're not all horrible kind of criminal perverts or something, I would say. But even so, I would not encourage anyone.
But I mean, some disabled people out there might welcome somebody who fancies their body. Would it be entirely wrong to accept the advances of a devotee?
I don't think it is wrong, as long as they're going completely aware of that situation. As in, if you can have casual sex and come out of it okay, which I hope disabled people are doing, quite frankly, because, you know, nice, safe, casual sex can be a learning curve. Mm. Who knows? I'm sure there are devotees that have fallen in love with their disabled object of desire. But there is a role for sex outside of love. I mean, most people know that. But for disabled people, if you've got, you know, if you find someone you really like and you feel like having sex, it can teach you a lot. If you trust them and it's fun. So you might just end up laughing. I've been lucky as I got older, in between my marriages, I've had sex where I've just been hysterical with laughter when things go wrong.
Yeah, it's just the human element, isn't it?
Yeah, and your partner's laughing, not laughing at you, and it might be that things go wrong both sides, and that's human.
Yeah, and that makes that's part of the fun of sex.
Yes, exactly. And I think that there is this big idea that everyone else is having amazing sex, non-disabled people, which isn't true. I've had so many non-disabled people make lovely comments about the Guardian piece last week, you know, and saying we don't have great sex all the time, and neither do I. Who does?
Thanks very much, Penny. Penny is an activist, a performer, and a writer. This has been Inside Ouch. Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Just a quick thank you to everybody who tweeted and emailed us the other week when we did our programme about Me Before You. People like Barbara Smith, Mark Thompson, Gilbert Aldous. Loads of you wrote in. Thanks for doing that. We appreciate it and we take all your comments on board. You can email us, ouch@bbc.co.uk. Tweet @BBC Ouch and find us on Facebook. Until next Friday, goodbye.
Bye.